What are your family's holiday food traditions and what do they mean to you? If you've never been to a Maine fish market on Christmas Eve, take note, there will be lines. People will be buying haddock for chowder, oysters for stew, and lobsters by the dozen. Perhaps it's no surprise in a coastal state with many Roman Catholic families that seafood is big for Christmas, but it is far from the only holiday food tradition in Maine. Maybe your family looks forward to buckwheat ploys or tortiere, latkes, or fruitcake. Maybe there's mulled cider simmering on the stove. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll learn about traditional holiday foods from a food editor, well-known cookbook author and historian, and a priest. And of course, we want to hear your stories about your favorite family food traditions. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. As the holidays approach, thoughts turn to gathering with family, exchanging gifts, going to church maybe, and eating lots of good, hearty comfort food. In Maine, traditional foods vary depending on your roots. You might associate holiday meals with lobster and chowder, or it might be about meat pies and pudding. Many Maine food traditions come from the longtime farm-to-table culture we have. No matter what the origins, we're known here for delicious and homey cuisine. With me in the studio to talk about these holiday food traditions, Peggy Grodinski. She is the food and source editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. And she's the former editor of Cook's Country Magazine. Nancy Harmon Jenkins is here. She's a food writer, cookbook author, culinary traveler, and food historian. And Paul Dume is pastor at St. Rose of Lima in Jay, as well as St. Joseph in Farmington. He is also an avid baker. As always, we want to hear from you. What foods do you associate with the holidays? Do you have a favorite Maine dish? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for joining me today. I'm sure this is going to make me very hungry by the end of the hour. But I want to start by asking each of you, and I'll start with you, Reverend Dume, about your own holiday food traditions. When you were a boy, where did you grow up, and what did you eat during the holidays?
I grew up in Madawaska, the most northern town in Maine. And, of course, there were always potatoes on the table, and there were big pots of chicken stew, especially the day after Christmas when everyone is unwinding a bit. And close to the large pots of chicken stew, there are always piles of ploys, a very well-known and local fare up north.
What is a ploy?
A ploy is a very simple buckwheat flatbread, typically Acadian in its origin. And it seems to live and thrive right there in Madawaska and the St. John River Valley on both sides of the river.
I'm going to return to that and ask you how to make a ploy, but I want to bring the others into the
sure.
conversation. Peggy, did your family have a food tradition on the holidays?
I am Jewish, so the food tradition, the holiday is Hanukkah. And the tradition is basically to fry things, which is supposed to represent the miracle of Hanukkah, which is when there was only enough oil to keep the temple lit for one day, but it lasted for 8 days. So you're supposed to eat deep fried things, which is a nice food tradition.
Is that because food is fried in oil?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Yes. So, and the most traditional one for Ashkenazi Jews, which is Jews from Europe, is potato latkes. So that was pretty much our tradition at Hanukkah.
So we're two for two on potatoes. Nancy, what about your food? Where did you grow up and what did you eat growing up?
I grew up on the coast of Maine and in Camden. And I was trying to think this morning about the last time I ever had a turkey for Christmas. And I think my grandmother was still alive. And I think my grandmother died in 1944. So it was a very long time ago. My mother had decided that lobster was the thing to have on Christmas. And so we always had a lobster feed. And it was a great way to get the family together. Everybody loved lobster. And we just, spread newspapers on the table and dumped the boiled lobsters in the middle and helped ourselves.
Let me ask you the logistics of that, though. How did you get a lobster on lobsters on Christmas morning?
I don't know. You'd have to ask my sainted mother. May she rest in peace.
Do you all carry on your family's traditions? I bet you're pretty busy on Christmas Day.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely busy with other things, but they're related. Like many holidays are associated with particular foods, as in the Jewish tradition and the Catholic tradition, that takes on a special significance. Take this day, for example, the Feast of St. Lucy, often associated with small sweetbreads or the lighting of candles or the putting of candles on a braided sweetbread. And so it's a very good, very deep human instinct to associate certain feasts with feasting.
Okay. And what about you, Peggy? Are you still making latkes during Hanukkah?
You know, I would say I generally go to a Hanukkah party. And
right.
That's probably pretty typical, that somebody has a party and everybody makes latkes. And sometimes when you read food magazines or food websites these days, people go a little crazy and rather than just potatoes, they make parsnip latkes or any old root vegetable and put all kinds of crazy contemporary flavorings on them. So sometimes I'll do that too.
And parsnips are very much in style, so
yeah.
That would make sense. What about you, Nancy? Do you continue the lobster tradition?
I do.
Feast tradition?
I let my daughter carry it on. My daughter has a restaurant, and so we take over the restaurant on Thanksgiving and Christmas Day, and it makes it all very, very easy. It's large enough to accommodate our not terribly large family, but, 15 or 20 people. And there's plenty of room for cooking and plenty of room for cutting up lobster and plenty of room for cleaning up afterwards. So it's a great day for doing that. I also, however, have a vegetarian son and daughter-in-law and two little granddaughters. So we have to make sure we provide enough vegetarian dishes for them. But we don't have any specific, frankly, I always used to hate all those vegetables that went with Christmas and with Thanksgiving. It seems to me they were the same thing. Boiled onions, mashed turnips, mashed squash. The only thing I really liked was mashed potatoes. And then at the very beginning of the meal, before we sat down, my mother would always put out celery stuffed with Philadelphia cream cheese. I loved that. I loved the mashed potatoes.
And she didn't put olives, sliced olives?
That was something else entirely. We had olives on the table. We had, one of those little crystal dishes that has the diagonal thing that goes down the middle of it. So you'd have the celery on one side and the olives on the other.
My mother always did the celery filled with the cream cheese and then a sliced olive going
on the
down.
Top. Oh, that's interesting.
Exactly.
That's very interesting. That's getting everything in there at once, isn't it?
Well, you could have less healthy ways to start your Christmas meal.
Consider pork pies, for example, and sugar pies.
I just want to throw out to all of you, what is it about food? Why is, in your opinion, food the thing that brings us together and we remember?
I think it's very obvious why it is. It's the way we define ourselves. And you'll find it's very interesting to me that years ago I wrote a book about American ethnic groups and their different foods. And one of the conclusions I came to that is that you define yourself as a community vis-a-vis the other communities around you. We are the people who eat tortilla. We are, that's what defines us. But it also the way you create French Canadian culture is by eating tortilla. And so food works in both ways. And it is a way of sustaining a community. You find a lot of ethnic groups who came to this country over the centuries that we have been a destination for people who lost a lot of their cultural identification. They lost their language. They lost their national costumes. But they always kept to the food.
Even through the generations.
I think so. I mean, the food gets morphed. I see this most particularly with Italian-American food, how the Feast of the Seven Fishes is one of these things that always makes me laugh. I've lived in Italy off and on for 40 years, and I have never found an Italian in Italy who knows what I mean when I talk about the Feast of the Seven Fishes. But everybody in the United States will tell you that it's an old Italian tradition to have the Feast of Seven Fishes on Christmas Eve.
And I know this is a subject, Paul, that you've thought about a great deal.
Consider the connection between locale, terrain, and food. And that's very, very significant. We celebrate, as we should, the local food movement. And there's something very basic about that. And sometimes our palate is trained, if you will, or shaped by the place that we live, the food that is in fact local. It's accessible. I like to think of the what Murata Cook calls some of Maine's poverty foods: beans, cabbage, potatoes, carrots, turnips, very basic things, very good things, very sustaining things. Secondly, I came across a wonderful quotation from the Greek philosopher Plato, who noted that in order to become friends, we must eat a kilo of salt together. And presumably he doesn't mean in one sitting, but over the course of some time, a little pinch at a time. And so food has that ability to bring us together in the most basic way, in the most human way, and also for the whole range of human emotions, experiences. You think of receptions after funerals, you think of community bean suppers, you think of receptions at weddings and other great feasts. Food is like the currency of friendship, if you will, the expression of that friendship.
I like that, the currency of friendship. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Peggy, you mentioned that you usually go to a Hanukkah party. So maybe these foods have changed from only being family to being community.
Hmm. And I'm thinking, because latkes, you have to grate all the potatoes and you have to grate a lot of onions, and it has to be done. They can be held, but they're not so good when they're held, so they have to be cooked at the last minute. It feels like a food that's a good communal food to cook, actually, that's fun to do with a lot of people around.
So part of the party is doing it together, not arriving and having it waiting on the table for you to eat. So I'm going to go down the aisle. I understand, Nancy, you have a tortilla with you, which I can't wait to sample. But I want you to tell me what it is. Tell me what its history is, as far as you know, and why it's important, an important holiday food tradition. And, you know, without going into details, how does one make this?
Oh, well, without going into too many details, you need a lard crust, first of all. It's a double-crusted meat pie. And I'm totally intimidated by Father Paul being here. I really don't dare say
no
very
fear.
Much about
I brought
it.
An old blessing of lard, which we'll get to later.
Oh.
And that'll put us all at ease.
A blessing of lard. I love it.
And I want to say that I started out this morning, I wanted to bring a gingerbread recipe that I found in an old Maine cookbook, which called for lard.
Oh,
it's fabulous.
But when I started, which sounded really delicious to me, to use lard as the fat in a gingerbread. But when I started making it, the flour measurement seemed really off, and I got a little nervous.
They often are in old Maine cookbooks.
So I didn't want to do it last minute without – I did something else. I was afraid to do something I hadn't done before.
I think lard is one of those Maine traditions that gets lost sometimes. And lard in a pie crust is really – it's the only way to make a decent pie crust is with lard in it, for a sweet pie or a savory pie. This is a savory pie because it has ground meat and onions and potatoes. The
potatoes.
Quintessential
three for three.
Franco potato, yes.
Yum.
And then I had a recipe that came from a friend of mine who's a very well-known food television personality in Montreal. And her tortilla had the strangest mixture of spices. I don't think anybody in Maine ever would use cardamom and cilantro and, all of those kind of nigella, which is a kind of dried onion seed. Nobody in Maine would ever use that. I left all that out, and I put in the traditional cloves and cinnamon and nutmeg and allspice.
And do we know why tortilla is traditional for the holidays?
I think maybe we'd turn to Father Paul for that.
That's a great question.
It just is.
It just is, and it's usually had after the midnight mass.
So when the fast is over.
Part of it is related to that, I think, the idea of this cycle of fasting in preparation for great feasts and then feasting as an embrace of that celebration. So I suspect we could discover that's part of the origin.
Okay. But I don't think a lot of people really observe the Advent fast any longer, do they?
No, it's more subdued. The Lenten fast would be more typical. You think of Mardi Gras, for example, as the big sort of familial feasting before Ash Wednesday, and then a more rigorous Lenten fast. But there is this penitential notion, this fasting element to Advent that we might do well to revisit in this cycle of fasting and feasting and to experience that full range of human emotion that comes with these great feasts, Jewish or Christian or otherwise.
It's a lovely cold weather meal. I mean, when I think about how cold people in Maine must have been before heating. you know, come back from Mass, that seems like an incredibly warming thing to eat to me.
Peggy, you and Nancy touched on briefly how old recipes sometimes are hard to follow. You said just this morning it seemed off. I won't project. Why do you think that is? Why is it difficult sometimes for us to follow recipes from old cookbooks?
Well, they knew how to cook very naturally. They didn't need so you mentioned the place that I worked before I came to Maine, which is called Cook's Country. It's part of America's Test Kitchen. And what they're famous for is rigorously testing everything and being incredibly precise about measurements so that you can't possibly make a mistake. And then what they say is, we make the mistakes so you don't have to. But I think that's because we're, to some extent, a nation of nervous cooks now. You know, that's probably overstating it, and there's certainly been a sort of huge rebirth and revival of interest in cooking. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who are very anxious about it. And the old recipes, they didn't need to tell you how to do anything because everybody knew.
Yeah, so there was a certain assumption of knowledge
exactly.
for the person, and that person would know if that flour amount was off, that it was off, and they just throw some more in.
Right. Which if I hadn't known that I was coming, you know, to talk to be an expert and talk about, you know, if I hadn't been worried that it would reflect badly on me if my gingerbread were terrible, I might have done. But having never made it before and looking at it anxiously, I thought, maybe not.
Okay. And so before we go to our first break, Father Dumais, I want you to tell me how to make ploy.
Oh, ploys. Ploys, wonderful. Simple flatbreads that combine Tartary buckwheat, which is the unique variety of buckwheat, very particular to northern Maine and maritime Canada, combined with all-purpose flour and a small amount of baking powder and salt.
That's it.
As simple as that. I call it the country cousin to the crepe.
And you add water or milk?
Water, typically, yep.
And cooked in a pan?
One-sided, so cooked through from the bottom without flipping it over like a breakfast pancake, because they're typically not breakfast pancakes. They're usually served along with meals at noon and in the evening, stews and beans. And so it's cooked through in 90 seconds. It sort of percolates to the top, sort of bubbles to the top. And has a nice sort of sponge-like face to it that holds lots of butter, by the way.
I was going to ask, what do you serve on it? Do you serve it as a side? Do you fill it with a filling like a crepe?
It's typically a side. Smear some butter on a hot ploy that comes off the cast iron griddle. Roll it up. Perch a couple on your plate or next to your stew and guard them.
And guard them. Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to go to a break. But first, I want to give the phone number, which is 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send us an email at talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'd love to hear about your holiday food traditions. Stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Salt Pump Climbing Company, who believe everyone should try exercise with excitement. Just off exit 42 of I-95 in Scarborough.
On May 6, 2010, high-speed trading bots sent the market into freefall.
This market is dropping precipitously.
We won't even start trading him on this 79-cent trading!
Several $100 billion vanished.
Information has a speed.
Like 9.79 seconds.
6,000 miles per second.
50 milliseconds.
On the next Radio Lab, we ask, is that speed leaving us behind or leading us to glory?
You can hear Radio Lab tonight at 11 o'clock. Many of your favorite Maine Public Television and PBS programs are now available to everybody online through our video on demand tool at mainepublic.org. And now, qualified supporters also have access to Passport, which allows extended access to many of the program archives, such as the ability to watch entire series or access past programs that previously may not have been available. Passport is already available to supporters of both Maine Public Television and radio at the $60 a year or $5 a month level. If you're interested in learning more or gaining access to Passport for yourself, please visit mainepublic.org. And thanks.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the food traditions that represent Maine's rich heritage, especially during the holidays. With me in the studio, Pastor Paul Dumais with St. Rose of Lima in Jay and St. Joseph in Farmington. Peggy Grodinski is food editor with the Portland Press Herald. And Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a food writer, cookbook writer, and food historian. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. There is a tortiere in this room with me, and it smells divine. But I want to take a picture of it and put it on our Facebook page before we dig in, because it's just so beautiful, Nancy.
Jennifer, I can give you the recipe, too, to put on the Facebook page.
Oh, that'd be terrific.
Yeah, or wherever.
Oh, I'd love that. Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. I'm going to start with Facebook. Lori says, we've invited all family and friends the Saturday after Christmas for a food festival for the last 20 years, a time to gather and celebrate the year and look forward to new beginnings in the year ahead. I do all the cooking and absolutely relish the time in my kitchen. Crepes galore. I'm usually cooking at least 100. Fresh fruit, lobster stew, hot mulled cider, ham, bacon, sausage, tortiere, mimosas, and sparkling wine. In our small house, that usually means anywhere from 40 to 60 people who drop in all day long. And Lori, I'll be right over.
How do they get an invitation? Yes, exactly.
The Saturday after Christmas. So that sounds like some of the things we've been talking about. Lobster stew, hot mulled cider, tortiere. Yum. What a great tradition. Here's an email from Anne. In the early 1980s, I worked in a Maine fish market. I remember every year in December and around Christmas, the market stocked live eels. Does anyone know the cultural history of this?
Yeah, that's a very Italian thing to do. In fact, I think that's the one fish that I've ever seen people eating on Christmas Eve in Italy. And mostly it's around Rome. And it used to be that they were the eels that swam in the River Tiber, which I don't think anybody would eat today. But it is very much an Italian tradition. And it's not easy to cook an eel. Have you ever tried to cook an eel, Peggy?
No, but I remember the terrifying scene from The Tin Drum. Do you remember that?
I never saw that.
Oh, you need to read that book and the scene about skinning an eel.
Yeah,
it's
very, very hard to do. It's not something to be described in polite company. but the eel itself is delicious. When it's roasted, it's just wonderful meat with not much bones in it and a very rich meat. It's really good.
If people haven't tasted it in the Italian context or, frankly, in the Maine context, because you see lots of recipes for eels in old Maine cookbooks also, or you occasionally see them at any rate, you've probably had it as sushi. Eel is very often and very popularly eaten on top of sushi with a very thick kind of brown sauce. So...
Okay. So I wanted to ask you, Father Dumais, about the tradition of bean suppers. I know that that's not really a holiday thing, but it's a very Maine thing. Where you're from in the county.
If it's Saturday night in the county, you're eating beans.
And may I ask the question that I've been wondering ever since I moved to Maine, which is why are the bean suppers so early?
Oh,
because people eat early.
5 o'clock. That's when my grandfather had supper. Yeah. So maybe that's the standard.
They're often over by, 5:30 or so.
Yeah, 6 o'clock is time to settle down and go to bed.
Yeah, so it's as simple as that.
Now, are the beans in the county beanhole beans? Are they? Is there a hole dug in the ground with hot?
Not necessarily. It's pretty basic in a clay bean pot, typically, or some other way. But pretty basic navy beans with some onions or lard or a little bit of dried mustard, either maple syrup or molasses. And oftentimes it becomes a dish at a community supper or church supper. When you bring people in from outside of Maine, they wonder why the side is all of a sudden the main course.
But it is. This is a very funny experience that I have. I went to Gould Academy many, many, many years ago, and we regularly had baked beans on Saturday night. All the boarders had baked beans on Saturday night, and we had baked beans for breakfast on Sunday morning with the most beautiful popovers I've ever seen in my life.
Do they still do that?
I doubt it very much. Huh. I think they get their food from the same Cisco or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Would they serve the beans on the pop? Like, would you spoon it onto your popover or eat them separately?
No, you'd eat them separately. I mean, you could spoon it on there if you felt like it. But really, it was a plate of beans and the popover on the side.
So I eat beans for breakfast often just because when I cook them, I tend to cook them. I put the pot in the oven when I go to bed. And then I hope no fire warden is listening to this. And then when I wake up, the house smells so incredible. You just feel like you have to eat a beans for breakfast.
You have to dig in.
But I've never tried a popover.
Well, it's a really good thing to have with it. If you can't get ploys, it's a good thing.
The next best thing. Let's give a shout out to Marifax, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Oh, yeah.
Beans. I was at the Belfast Co-op recently, and I was eagerly hoping to find some because it's one of the places where you can, and the bulk bin was empty. And so that's a call to action for people to be growing Marifax beans, which, as I understand it, is the traditional Maine bean.
Is that a white bean or a red bean? Or
it's a white bean, larger than a pea bean or a navy bean. But as I'm understanding it and like to learn more about it, it's the Maine bean that would have been quite common along the coast and in other parts of Maine.
Okay.
But then there's also Jacob's cattle beans. Mm-hmm. And I learned a long time ago something that you probably know from your reading of the Old Testament, why they're called Jacob's cattle beans. That's a wonderful bean for baked beans, too. I always thought it was because they were originally fed to cattle. No, it's because they're like Jacob's cattle in the Old Testament. They're speckled and spotted.
Ah, okay. So we're going to go to Westbrook and Caitlin. Hi, Caitlin. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I wanted to say hello to Father Paul, who actually married my husband, David.
Oh, sounds like Caitlin Cunningham.
It is. Hi. And then I'm a terrible cook, as Father Paul can probably attest to or may know. And I wanted to know what some basic recipes are for somebody just getting started.
Basic recipes for
where can I start?
What, Caitlin?
For the holiday, Caitlin?
Yeah, so a main dish that I can do as a terrible cook.
Oh, I would say make a chowder for Christmas Eve. It's so easy to make a good chowder, and it doesn't require much of anything except really good fish or really good clams. And wonderful chowder can be made with Finn and Haddie if you can acquire that. And all you have to do is sauté some onions in some pork fat again, and throw in some potatoes, and let the potatoes cook down, and then rest the fish on it and add some milk and salt and pepper and butter and, I don't know, maybe a bay leaf or two. It's very easy to do, and there are loads of recipes for it, so I don't think you should be intimidated by that.
Can I add that if you find a complicated recipe for chowder, ignore it?
Yes.
Keep searching
Absolutely.
Until you find a simple recipe?
Absolutely.
And I'd say the only thing to be careful of is to not overcook the fish, and other than that, not much can go wrong.
And don't put any flour in it.
There you go, Caitlin. How do you all feel about bacon? That's a little bit of a debate in my family about whether or not to put bacon
salt
in a chowder.
Salt pork versus bacon, meaning? Or just bacon?
In general.
Oh, I love bacon, but I don't think I'd put it in a chowder. I think salt pork is much. Because if you're going to make a chowder with Finn and Haddie, you don't need bacon anyway because
it's salty.
It's salty and smoky, and it's got all of those flavors already in it.
I love a chowder just with really fresh haddock. Yum. Mm-hmm.
Roasted vegetables, Caitlin. That's it seems like any vegetable that is roasted in the oven draws out some extra special flavor, and it's a simple approach.
And you can eat it. You don't really need to eat it hot. You can eat it at room temperature, and it's equally delicious, so you don't have to be anxious about the timing of cooking.
Good luck, Caitlin. We're going to move up to Bangor and Sharon. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling. Sharon, go ahead. Hopefully you'll try back. We'll go to Belgrade then and Esther. Hi, Esther. Go ahead.
Hi. So thanks for taking my call. My grandmother, we always go to my grandmother's house on Christmas. It's like 40 of us there. And we always have a Christmas ham. And in the summer, my grandmother would take me wild strawberry picking. And I would, be picking and picking. I'd have like half a cup. And I would look over, and her bowl would be completely full of wild strawberries. And she would can the strawberries, and then at Christmas time, she would open them and heat them up and just add a little sugar and we would have that with our Christmas ham.
Oh, how wonderful. Yum.
Yeah, and she would also make rolls, just a plain rolled dough, and she would put butter on that dough all flat, and then she would sprinkle cinnamon sugar on that and put raisins in, and then she would roll it and cut it, so it was like swirl rolls, and we would have the strawberry sauce on those rolls, too.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. Well, Esther, thanks for sharing, and you have to know that people here in the studio have been taking notes as you were speaking, so that's a terrific story. Thank you. We have a note here, an email from Zora. She writes, I am not Mexican, but grew up in Southern California, and now I live in Maine. Tamales are a Christmas tradition in Mexican families. Last year, my daughter and I made 100 tamales, four different kinds, and invited 25 people over to eat them.
Yeah. I was one of the people invited, and I couldn't go in the end. I can't remember why. I really felt terrible not being able to go to it.
Yes, I used to live in Texas, which also very often have tamales for New Year's or for Christmas, and it's a lovely tradition. And I had a very close friend who is her background is Hispanic, and she also, for Christmas, not only tamales, but everybody brought their children, and there was a piñata, and that was a big part of the tradition, knocking the kids knocking the candy out of the piñata.
You know, it's making me think, too, if you do not have a family food tradition, you can pick. You could be listening to this program today and say, I think I would like to have ploys be my new family tradition and, or have lobster.
I brought something. I'm sorry to interrupt. I brought something that I made this morning, which was cranberry curd, because I decided that would be my.
What is cranberry curd?
Do you know what lemon curd is?
Yeah.
So it's pretty much the same, only you use cranberries instead of lemons.
Mm. Oh, my goodness. I've got to up my game, guys. Let's see here. We're going to go to Lewiston and Mitch. Hi, Mitch. Go ahead.
Hi. First of all, I just wanted to say hello to Father Paul, who I recently met. I'm the director at the Franco Center.
Oh, yes. Mitch, welcome.
And yeah, thank you. And what an all-star panel you got there. This is great. First of all, going back to the bean supper thing, I grew up with bean suppers, literally being in my grandmother's kitchen while she baked the big beans and the brown bread. That was her job for all of my life. And then when we get there, I would just add that the reason it's so early, Jennifer, is because even though they're scheduled and announced for like 5 to 6:30 or even 5:30 to 7, people arrive at like 3:30 or 4. And I think church people are such pushovers, they just let them in when everything's ready. But it always bothered me, too, because it was advertised for 5 to 6:30, and I'd show up at 6, and all the food was gone.
Yeah, I was going to say, you have to be, like in a big family, you have to be first in.
I've been wanting to stage a protest on this for years, but I don't know that we can take on the Catholic and Protestant churches in Maine to do that. It is definitely.
You know, there's another thing that goes with those baked bean suppers I always think of, and that's coleslaw.
Coleslaw and the casseroles.
Yes.
It's just, yeah, they're the best. Coming back to home here in Lewiston at the Franco Center, we serve a lot of crepes and a lot of tortillas. And during our events, mostly at the intermissions and sometimes before the shows and with some of our special meals. My question is, we serve the crepes the same way all the time, but I want to do crepes this year with my family at Christmas. And I'm wondering, is there a special way to dress them up at Christmas time versus just how we normally would do them?
So you're saying you're not talking about ploys, you're talking about crepes.
Well, ploys or crepes. I think either, yeah.
When I was making cranberry curd this morning, which I did partly because I thought, oh, Maine has a little cranberry crop and it's such a beautiful color for Christmas. I did think it would be lovely to just take some cranberries and sugar and orange zest or ginger or whatever you felt like flavoring it with and put it, fill crepes with maybe mascarpone or some nice cheese and then put a nice little cranberry sauce on it. And it would be a pretty color.
Yes, savory crepes are always a good alternative. A little bit of shaved ham or cheeses of various kinds.
Mm.
Mushrooms.
There you go, Mitch. Some suggestions. We have a Facebook post from Angela. She writes, have recently switched over to Marfax beans for baked beans, and they are delicious. So there we go. Some confirmation of what you were saying.
She emptied the bin at the
it's her fault, right? You're coming after Angela. So let's see. Before we go to one more break, we'll go to Sharon in Bangor calling back. Hi, Sharon. Are you there now?
Yes.
Yay.
Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to share the fact that there are so many nationalities and customs in this area in Maine. My husband was half Lebanese, and I was so blessed to spend Thanksgiving with his family. And not only would we have turkey and ham and all the traditional New England dishes, but we would have rice and ham or lamb, rice and lamb, and we would have cabbage rolls. And then at Christmas, his friend who lived over here on Broadway would make za'ata, which is kind of like a Syrian flatbread with spices on top as a Christmas gift. Oh, the food was just so good. And then I also think of the Greeks, and they make their baklava for people. There's just so many cultures. And by the way, I still make my grandmother's brown bread. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Well, thank you, Sharon, for adding to that. And both Nancy and Peggy were nodding away. They're knowledgeable of the food you speak.
Knowledgeable, yes. And also, I think she made a really good point about, you know, we tend kind of in a sloppy intellectual way to think of Maine as being both French and Anglo and nothing else. And yet we've got Greeks, we've got Lebanese, we've got new people coming from Africa, Asians, and even a lot of Latinos coming in to work here. And they're all changing our food. And that's the exciting thing about food, that it changes all the time.
If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We're going to take one more break.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Poetry Foundation, providing poems for every occasion. Learn more at poetryfoundation.org.
Maine Public is announcing an exciting new comprehensive fundraising campaign, the largest in our history. $30 million, which is helping this organization grow to meet the needs of our diverse audience. We're calling it Charting a Bold Future, and the effort is designed to improve and expand our news coverage, grow our FM classical music network, make online programming even more widely available, while strengthening our overall organization. To learn how you can contribute and support Charting a Bold Future, go to mainepublic.org and click on the red donate button on the top right of the screen.
And join us at 2 o'clock following Maine Calling for the Commonwealth Club of California. Today's speaker is film director Francis Ford Coppola, who talks about the making of The Godfather. That's the Commonwealth Club of California coming up after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Sorry that the show is interrupting our tasting of Nancy Harmon Jenkins' tortiere, and it's delicious. Today on the program, Maine food traditions, holiday dishes, and family favorites. And with me today, Nancy Harmon Jenkins, who's a cookbook author and food historian, Paul Dumais, a pastor and baker, and Peggy Grodinski with the Portland Press Herald. She's the food editor there. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Be patient. We'll get to the phones in just a minute. So put in that call in just a second if you can. I want to talk about fruitcake. How do you all feel about it? Are you fans?
I think it's so unfairly maligned.
Okay.
Yes, I think fruitcake can be delicious when it's done well. There was a period of time where everybody was putting sort of terrible, the fruits, the citron and these awful, I'm sure in Italy they probably have incredible dried fruit.
I just did a story about something called pan pepato, which is, if you know what pan forte is, it's not really a cake because there's no flour in it. It's what we would call a tort. Like a tortiere. And it has lots and lots of nuts and lots of candied fruit in it. And the candied fruit, I found it really, really hard to get good quality candied
fruit
here.
Exactly. I mean, people say all the time in the sort of buy local movement, you know, or chefs say all the time, you can't cook well if you don't start with good ingredients. And in this country, at least in my lifetime, fruitcake has almost never started with good ingredients.
Right.
So small wonder people, talk about using it as a doorstop.
Father Dumais, what are your thoughts about fruitcake?
I wonder if stolen could be a good alternative.
Yes.
I've had some luck with that, incorporating dried fruit and a few nuts, and which is a specific Christmas tradition. The shape of the stolen is intended to be the like the swaddling clothes in, enveloping a little baby.
Speaking of fruitcake, Tammy in Charleston has a fruitcake story. Hi, Tammy. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? I'm so glad you're having this program today. Just thought I'd share with you a tradition from our book group. A woman named Selma Ditzel, one of our members, used to make a fruitcake every year. It's a recipe to die for. She passed away back in 2000, and her daughter, T, who lives in Virginia, now makes the recipe and mails it up to us every year. It's the only fruitcake my husband and I will eat, and I make sure I take him some home every year after the meeting. And it's just delicious. It's moist. It's tasty. So,
what's special about it? What's in it that's different than other fruitcakes?
I don't know. I often think of fruitcakes as dry and, you know, kind of the brick that you use to hold the door open. And this is just very moist. It's very tasty. I think I taste nutmeg and cinnamon, and it's just so delicious. And I'm sure she's probably got some alcohol in there, but I think that's normal for fruitcake because I'm not much of a cook either. But that stuff, everybody likes that.
Do you cook on Christmas? I'm always curious of people who say they don't cook so much if they do cook on the holidays.
Christmas, my husband is the cook in the family, to be honest. In fact, it's a running joke in our family. I'll ask the kids if they're coming home for the weekend, and they'll ask who's cooking. And if I'm cooking, it's like, well, maybe. But if Jeff's cooking, oh, yeah, we'll be there.
Oh, that's funny. I read that recently about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that her children asked her if her husband could do the cooking, which I thought was very kind of her to share. We're going to go to Angela, who's calling from Kennebunk. Hi, Angela. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to add my heritage to the mix. I grew up in a thoroughly Italian household, and some of the things that we prepared at Christmas that was especially meaningful to all of us was what is called a pizza dolce, which is an Italian-style cheesecake made with pasta froia, a wonderful shortbread crust, and then a ricotta filling. And we also would add dried fruits like citron.
Mm.
And it's absolutely delicious. And I hesitated to make it a couple of years ago because my mother made it so beautifully. But I took the plunge, and my brother gave me kudos. So that made me feel very, very good.
And you know, Angela, Nancy Harmon Jenkins has been kind enough to say that she will share her recipe for tortiere on our Facebook page. And if you feel as generous, go ahead and post on the Maine Calling Facebook page the recipe.
Oh, I'd love to see it. I'd love to see it.
I would be delighted to share it with everyone. It really is lovely. I'm still experimenting with it to find the perfect one, but I did come up with a pretty good facsimile.
Okay, thank you so much. And you know, it's interesting. She said still experimenting with it. You said you're still experimenting with tortiere. Do Peggy and Father Dume, do you all have things you're still that you are going to make it perfect one of these days?
It's good to work to make it your own. I incorporated tartary buckwheat into a naturally leavened bread that I called Madawaska bread because I mixed in not only the tartary buckwheat but some roasted potato. And so it's important, I think, to be brave and to bring together new combinations.
May I ask you a question about the buckwheat? I actually tried getting I forget what it's called, but the Ploys mix that they sell in the supermarket.
Oh, the Bouchard Family Farm has been successful in marketing a Ploy mix through Hannaford, yep.
Exactly. And then I was baking a cake that called for buckwheat flour, so I just threw it in there. And it tasted different than I remember the cake usually tasting, and I didn't really know why.
If it was Ploy mix, it would have had all-purpose flour as well as salt and baking powder. If it was just the tartary buckwheat flour, it's a very fine flour. It's pretty mild tasting, distinct from the brown Japanese type buckwheat that is more typical of soba noodles.
It's interesting. I just came back from a long trip up in the county looking at grain growing, and there's a lot going on with it's barley, not buckwheat. Sorry, I'm getting the two confused. Yeah, barley, malting barley for all the breweries in Maine, which Christmas beer is a great tradition too. I think I predict it will become a tradition here,
based on the supply of very good.
Well, it's astounding the number of breweries we have.
It isn't doubled just last year, I believe. Right? Oh, amazing! We're going to move on to Freeport and Tom. Hi, Tom. Go ahead.
Hi, good Yule. Good Yule. I'm thinking a little about the Scandinavian food. And I married into a Swedish family. I'm a Limey, but I moved in, married in, went to them. And they have korv, which is a kind of a sausage. They have pickled herring, meatballs, ham. And then they have special cookies called spritz. So it's sort of a smorgasbord. And if they're so inclined to alcohol, aquavit is a good shot to have, too.
I made spritz growing up. Lots of butter.
Yes.
Lots of butter.
Yeah, a big tradition in the county just south of where the man of the cloth's from is a Swedish enclave near Caribou. So
New Sweden, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we have today in the Press Herald, no, I'm sorry, tomorrow in the Press Herald, three recipes from chefs of what they serve their family, and one of them is Swedish meatballs.
Oh, great. So. We'll have to look forward to that. Thanks, Peggy. And thanks, Tom, for your call. I'm going to Kathy in Orono.
Hi. I've been enjoying your show. And my tradition was, my family's tradition growing up in Maine, in Brunswick, was to drive over to Hebron, East Hebron, and near South Paris, where there was a large Finnish community. My grandparents were Finns with a dairy farm. And on Christmas afternoon, or any other holiday, the special occasion was always setting the coffee table. And it wasn't a coffee table in the living room. It was serving coffee at the dining room table for Christmas, because it was a special holiday, there would be seven items, sweets, maybe a filled cake. But my very favorite was nisu. Other Finns call it pola. And it's a braided bread flavored with cardamom, and, of course, pots and pots of coffee. So a white tablecloth, and we always look forward to that because my grandmother was a wonderful Finnish baker, and that's one of my favorite memories.
I didn't quite understand. Is that something that comes after the Christmas feast itself?
It's any afternoon that you're in a Finnish home.
Around Christmas time.
On a holiday, if it's just dropping by, you'd have three items to serve with your afternoon coffee. Finns drink coffee multiple times a day. They still do. I have cousins in Finland. But it's the 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock coffee is very important in their day. But when it's a holiday, like Christmas or someone's birthday, but particularly Christmas is what I'm remembering, there'd be seven items of food on the table to go with a coffee. So you didn't want to have eaten a huge dinner because your coffee hour was coming with the sweet bread, with the nisu, the pola, the filled layered cake, and other usually sweet delicacies to go with the coffee.
Kathy, thanks so much for your call. That sounds like a wonderful tradition. We have an email from Maxine. Has anyone ever heard of Bishop's bread? It's similar to fruitcake. My mother-in-law makes it, and it's delicious. It's a dark bread with cherries, walnuts, dates, and chocolate chunks. It's really good warm with a spread of softened cream cheese, I bet. Have you all heard of Bishop's
I've
bread?
I've heard of it, but I can't say anything beyond that. I've just heard the name.
Okay, and then let's see here. From Ruth, donuts are another typical Hanukkah item due to the fried element. A jelly donut is especially traditional. How about molasses donuts in Maine, traditional for Christmas? And that's a question she's asking. Are molasses donuts traditional?
The jelly donut is called sufganiyot, and it's in the last maybe 20 years, a lot of American Jews have started eating it. It is obviously it's fried, so it fits that as well. But I grew up as an Ashkenazi Jew. Those were unheard of in the U.S. until maybe 20, 25 years ago, I would say, among most Jews. But it's very much become part of the Hanukkah tradition. And then another thing, I'll just add one more thing for Hanukkah, which is that cheese is often eaten. And there's a story that there was, I think she was supposed to be a widow, but I might have that wrong, named Judith, who there was a Syrian general who was going to kill, who was fighting the Jewish people. And in order to make him sleepy, she fed him lots of cheese and wine and then beheaded him.
Judith and the Head of Holofernes.
Exactly. That's, yeah, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And we have one more. Let's see. My notes are bouncing around on me here. Let's see. I just saw this is an email from Sharon. We are Jewish and love our Christmas tradition of Chinese food and the movies. I think I don't think that's a particularly Maine food tradition, though. I think you're going to find people all over the United States who like to have Chinese food on Christmas. We just have a little bit of time left, and I was just wondering if I could get some final thoughts for you about food and the holidays, Father Dume. Is it about the food or is it about being together?
Well, it's a wonderful combination. Food is sacramental in its character. It has a visible quality and an invisible quality. And I think that's an important principle to appreciate and to continue to explore and ritualize in our lives and friendships. And certainly within the context of the faith, I'd refer you to a website called Catholic Cuisine that searches out and celebrates some of those wonderful customs and traditions. And it, I think there's an important conversation to be had between Catholics who have a very rich liturgical history and customs and the local food movement, oftentimes who are deeply spiritual persons and appreciate their spiritual quality of food, of local food, and of the friendship that arises from shared foods.
All right. You all have final thoughts, Peggy, about...
I don't think I can follow up on that. That was so beautifully said.
I would like to ask Father Paul to read the blessing of the Lord.
Oh, that's right. I'm glad you remembered, Nancy. Just enough time for the blessing of the Lord.
Let us pray. Lord, bless this thy creature, lard, and let it be healthful food for all. Grant that everyone who eats it with thanksgiving to your holy name may find it a help in body and soul.
Amen.
And there is good lard to be had in Maine now. Many farmers, if you go to the farmer's market, you can find often really excellent leaf lard.
I don't think we've ever ended a Maine Calling program that well. Thank you all for being here today. Paul Dume is pastor at St. Rose of Lima and Jay, as well as St. Joseph in Farmington. Peggy Grodinski is food and source editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Nancy Harmon Jenkins is a food writer, cookbook author, culinary traveler, and food historian. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, join me for a conversation with Travis Mills, the retired U.S. Army staff sergeant who was a wounded warrior, motivational speaker, and advocate for veterans and amputees. His best-selling book is now out in paperback. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.